I'll get you all the development allocation you need. Tell them that. And before the end of that week, I had an appointment with a systems researcher at the Western Electric Research Facility outside of Princeton, New Jersey, right down the road from the Institute for Advanced Study. I told him it came out of foreign technology, something that the intelligence people picked up from new weapons the East Germans were developing but thought we could use. If what you think you have, he said over the phone, is that interesting and shows us where our research is going, we'd be silly not to lend you an ear for an afternoon. I'll need less than an afternoon to show you what I got, I said. Then I packed my Roswell field reports into my briefcase, got myself an airline ticket for a flight to Newark Airport, and I was on my way. Super Tenacity Fibers. Even before the 1960s, when I was still on the National Security Staff, the Army had begun to look for fibers for flak jackets, shrapnel-proof body armor, even parachutes, and a protective skin for other military items. Silk had always been the material of choice for parachutes because it was light, yet had an incredible tensile strength that allowed it to stretch, keep shape, and yet withstand tremendous forces. Whether the Army's search for what they called a tenacity fiber was prompted purely by its need to find better protection for its troops or because of what their retrieval team found at Roswell, I do not know. I suspect, however, that it was the discovery at the crash site that began the Army's search. Among the items in my Roswell file that we retained from the retrieval were strands of a fiber that even razors couldn't cut through. When I looked at it under a magnifying glass, its dull grayness and almost matte finish belied the almost supernatural properties of this fiber. You could stretch it, twist it around objects, and subject it to a level of torque that would rend any other fiber, but this held up. Then, when you released the tension, it snapped back to its original length without any loss of tension in its original form. It reminded me of the filaments in a spider web. We became very interested in this material and began to study a variety of technologies, including spider silks because they, alone in nature, exhibit natural supertenacity properties. The spider's spinning of its silk begins in its abdominal glands as a protein that the spider extrudes through a narrow tube that forces all the molecules to align in the same direction, turning the protein into a rod-like, very long, single thread with a structure not unlike a crystal. The extrusion process not only aligns the protein molecules. The molecules are very compressed, occupying much less space than conventionally sized molecules. This combination of lengthwise aligned and supercompressed molecules gives this thread an incredible tenacity and the ability to stretch under enormous pressure while retaining its tensile strength and integrity. A single strand of this spider silk thread would have to be stretched nearly 50 miles before breaking, and if stretched around the entire globe, it would weigh only 15 ounces. Clearly, when the scientists at Roswell saw how this fiber, not cloth, not silk, but something like a ceramic, had encased the ship and formed the outer skin layer of the Ebbies, they realized it was a very promising avenue for research. When I examined the material and recognized its similarity to spider thread, I realized that a key to producing this commercially 109 would be to synthesize the protein and find a way to simulate the extrusion process. General Trudeau encouraged me to start contacting plastics and ceramics manufacturers, especially Monsanto and Dow, to find out who was doing research on super tenacity materials, especially at university laboratories. My quick poll paid off. I not only discovered that Monsanto was looking for a way to develop a mass production process for a simulated spider silk, I also learned that they were already working with the Army. Army researchers from the Medical Corps were trying to replicate the chemistry of the spider gene to produce the silk manufacturing protein. Years later, after I'd left the Army, researchers at the University of Wyoming and Dow Corning also began experiments on cloning the silk manufacturing gene and developing a process to extrude the silk fibers into a usable substance that could be fabricated into a cloth. Our research and development liaison in the medical corps told me that the replication of a super tenacity fiber was still years away back in 1962, but that any help from foreign technology that we could give the medical corps would find its way to the companies they were working with and probably wouldn't require a separate R&D budget. The development funding through US government medical and biological research grants was more than adequate, the medical corps officer told me, to finance the research unless we needed to develop an emergency crash program. But I still remain fascinated by the prospect that something similar to a web spinner had spun the strands of super tenacity fabric around the spaceship. I knew that whatever that secret was, amalgamating a skin out of some sort of fabric or ceramic around our aircraft would give them the protection that the Roswell craft had and still be relatively lightweight. Again, I didn't find out about it until much later, but research into that very type of fabrication was already underway by a scientist who would, years later, win a Nobel Prize. At a meeting of the American Physical Society 3 years before, Dr. Richard Feynman gave a theoretical speculative assessment of the possibilities of creating substances whose molecular structure was so condensed that the resulting material might have radically different properties from the non-compressed version of the same material. For example, Feynman suggested, if scientists could create material in which the molecular structures were not only compressed but arranged differently from conventional molecular structures, the scientists might be able to alter the physical properties of the substance to suit specific applications. This seemed like brand new stuff to the American Physical Society. In reality, though, compressed molecular structures were one of the discoveries that had been made by some of the original scientific analytical groups both at Alamogordo right after the Roswell crash and at the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, which took delivery of the material. As a young atomic physicist, Richard Feynman was a colleague of many of the post-war atomic specialists who were in the Army's and then the Air Force's guided missile program as well as the nuclear weapons program in the 1950s. Although I never saw any memos to this effect, Feynman was reported to have been in contact with members of the Alamogordo group of the Air Materiel Command and knew about some of the finds at the Roswell crash site. Whether these discoveries suggested theories to him about the potential properties of compressed molecular structures or whether his ideas were also extensions of his theories about the quantum mechanics behavior of electrons, for which he won the Nobel Prize, I don't know. But Dr. Feynman's theories about compressed molecular structures dovetailed with the Army efforts to replicate the super tenacity fiber composition and extrusion processes. By the middle of the 1960s, work was underway not only at large industrial ceramics and chemical companies in the United States but in university research laboratories here, and in Europe, Asia, and India. With my questions about who was conducting research into super tenacity fibers answered and learning where that research was taking place, I could turn my attention to other applications of the technology to see whether the Army could help move the development along faster or whether any collateral development was possible to create products in advance of the super tenacity fibers. Our scientists told us that one way to simulate the effect of super 110 tenacity was in the cross-alignment of composite layers of fabric. This idea was the premise for the Army's search for a type of body armor that would protect against the skin-piercing injuries of explosive shrapnel and rounds fired from guns. Now this won't protect you against contusions, General Trudeau told me after a meeting with Army Medical Corps researchers at Walter Reed. And the concussive shock from an impact will still be strong enough to kill anybody, but at least it's supposed to keep the round from tearing through your body. I thought about the many blunt trauma wounds you see in a battle and could imagine the impact a large round would leave even if it couldn't penetrate the skin. But through the general's impetus and the contacts he set up for me at DuPont and Monsanto, we aggressively pursued the research into the development of a cross-aligned material for bulletproof vests. I hand-carried the field descriptions of the fabric found at Roswell to my meetings at these companies and showed the actual fabric to scientists who visited us in Washington. This was not an item we wanted to risk carrying around the country. By 1965, DuPont had announced the creation of the Kevlar fabric that, by 1973, was brought to market as the Kevlar bulletproof vest that's in common use today in the armed services and law enforcement agencies. I don't know how many thousands of lives have been saved, but every time I hear of a police officer whose Kevlar vest protected him from a fatal chest or back wound, I think back to those days when we were just beginning to consider the value of cross-aligned layers of super tenacity material, and am thankful that our office played a part in the product's development. Our search for super tenacity materials also resulted in the development of composite plastics and ceramics that withstood heat and the pressures of high-speed air maneuvers and were also invisible to radar. The cross-stitched super tenacity fibers on the skin of the Roswell vehicle, which I believe had been spun on, also became an impetus for an entirely new generation of attack and strategic aircraft, as well as composite materials for future designs of attack helicopters. One of the great rumors that floated around for years after the Roswell story became public with the testimony of retired Army Air Force Major Jesse Marcel before he died was that stealth technology aircraft were the result of what we learned at Roswell. That is true. But it was not a direct transfer of technology. Army intelligence knew that under certain conditions the Ebi spacecraft had the ability to hide their radar signature, but we didn't know how they did it. We also had pieces of the Roswell spacecraft's skin, which was a composite of super tenacity molecular aligned fibers. As far as I know, we've still not managed to recreate the exact process to manufacture this composite, just like we've not been able to duplicate the electromagnetic drive and navigation system that enabled the Roswell vehicle to fly, even though we have that vehicle and others at either Norton, Edwards, and Nellis Air Force Bases. But through the study of how this material worked and what its properties are, we've replicated composites and rolled an entirely new generation of aircraft off the assembly line. Although the American public first heard about the existence of a stealth technology in President Jimmy Carter's campaign against President Ford in 1976, we didn't see the stealth in action until the air attacks on Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. There, the stealth fighter, completely invisible to Iraqi radar, launched the first high-risk assaults on the Iraqi Air Force air defense system and operated with almost complete impunity. Invisible to radar, invisible to heat-seeking missiles, striking out of the night sky like demons, the stealth fighters, with their flying wing almost crescent-shaped, look uncannily like the space vehicle that crashed into the Arroyo outside of Roswell. But appearances aside, the composite skin of the stealth that helps make it invisible to almost 111. All forms of detection was inspired by the Army R&D research into the skin of the Roswell aircraft that we sectioned apart for distribution to laboratories around the country. Depleted uranium invisible artillery shells. For the Air Force, stealth technology meant that aircraft could approach a target invisible to radar and maintain that advantage throughout the mission. For the Army, stealth technology for its helicopters provides an incredible advantage in mounting search and destroy, special forces recon, or counterinsurgency missions deep into enemy territory. But the possibility of a stealth artillery shell, which we conceived of at R&D in 1962, would have allowed us something armies have sought ever since the first deployment of artillery by a Western European army at Henry V's victory at Agincourt in the early 15th century. Certainly Napoleon would have wanted this ability when he deployed his artillery against the British line at Waterloo. So would the Germans in World War I when their artillery pounded the Allied forces hunkered down in their trenches, and again at the Battle of the Bulge in 1944 when those of us stationed in Rome could only pray that our boys could hang on until the clouds broke and our bombers could hit the German emplacements. In all artillery battles, once a shell is fired, it can be tracked by an observer back to its source, and then return fire can be directed against whoever is firing. But as the range of artillery increased and we found ways to camouflage guns, we became proficient in hiding artillery until the advent of battlefield radar, which allows the trajectory of shells to be tracked back to their source. But imagine if the shell were composed of a material that rendered it invisible to radar. That was the possibility we proposed to General Trudeau, an invisible artillery shell, I suggested to him in his office one morning as we were designing the plan for research and development of composite materials. On the night battlefield of the future, you could deploy weapons that were invisible even to radar tracking planes flying overhead behind the lines. Shells would start falling, and the enemy wouldn't know where they were coming from until after we had the advantage of 5 or more unanswered salvos. By then, and with the advantage of surprise, the damage might well be done. If we were using mechanized artillery, we could set up positions, fire a series of quick salvos, redeploy, and set up again. The secret lay not just in the same stealth aircraft technology but also in the development of a stealth ceramic that could withstand tremendous explosive barrel pressures and still maintain an integrity through the arc of its trajectory. The search for just such a molecularly aligned composite ceramic was inspired by the composite material of the Roswell spacecraft. In analysis after analysis, the Army tried to determine how the extraterrestrials fabricated the material that formed the hull of the spacecraft but was unable to do so. The search for the kind of molecularly aligned composite began in the 1950s, even before General Trudeau took command of R&D, continued during my tenure at Foreign Technology when the early stealth experimentation began at Lockheed that resulted in the F-117 fighter and stealth bomber, and continues right through to today. The general was also more than interested in the kinds of warheads we would propose for just such a shell, a warhead that did come into use in 1961 and was successfully deployed during the Gulf War. And we had a suggestion for a round that we thought could change the nature of the kinds of battles we projected we'd be fighting against the Warsaw Pact forces, a warhead fabricated out of depleted uranium. This was a way to utilize the stockpile of uranium we foresaw we'd have as a result of spent fuel from commercial nuclear reactors, reactors powering US Navy vessels, and the nuclear reactors the Army was developing for its own bases and for delivery to bases overseas. Depleted uranium was a dense, heavy metal, so dense in fact that conventional armament was no match for a high-speed round tipped with it. Its ability to penetrate even the toughest of tank armor and detonate once it was inside the enemy vehicle meant that a single round fired 112 from one of our own tanks equipped with a laser range finder would disable, if not completely destroy, an enemy tank. Depleted uranium would give us a decided advantage on the European battlefield on which we knew we'd be outnumbered 2 or 3 to 1 by the Warsaw Pact or in China where sheer numbers alone would mean that either we'd be overwhelmed or we'd have to resort to nuclear weapons. The depleted uranium shell kept us from having to go nuclear. Privately, I suggested to General Trudeau that depleted uranium also fulfilled a hidden agenda. It was another weapon in a potential arsenal we were building against hostile extraterrestrials. If depleted uranium could penetrate armor, might the heaviness of the element enable it to penetrate the composite skin of the spacecraft, especially if the spacecraft were on the ground? I suggested that it certainly merited development at the nearby Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, and if it proved worthwhile, it was a weapon we should deploy. Even though the composite ceramic stealth round is still an elusive dream in weapons development, the depleted uranium-tipped warhead saw action in the Gulf War, where it didn't just disable the tanks of the Iraqi Republican Guard, it exploded them into pieces. Fired from the laser range finder-equipped Abrams tanks, TOW missile launchers, or even from Hedgehog infantry support aircraft, the depleted uranium-tipped warheads wreaked havoc in the Gulf. They were one of the great weapons development successes of Army R&D that came out of what we learned from the Roswell crash. HAARP, the High Altitude Research Project. HAARP was another project whose need for research and development was suggested to us by the challenge posed by flying saucers. They could outfly our own aircraft, we had no guided missiles that could bring them down, and we didn't have any guns that could shoot them down. We were also exploring weapons systems that had a double or triple use, and HA, or the Big Gun, was one such system. Essentially, Project HARP was the brainchild of Canadian gunnery expert and scientist Dr. Gerald Bull. Bull had studied the threat posed by the German Big Bertha in World War I and the Nazi V3 supergun toward the end of World War II. He realized that long-range, high-powered artillery was not only a practical solution to launching heavy payload shells, it was very affordable once the initial research and development phase was completed. Mass-produced big guns and their ordnance, assembled in stages right on the site, could provide enormous firepower well back from the front lines to any army. They would become a strategic weapon to rain nuclear destruction down on enemy population centers or military staging areas. Dr. Bull had also suggested that the gun could be retasked as a launch vehicle, blasting huge rounds into orbit, which could then be jettisoned, like the booster stage of a rocket, so the payload warhead could thrust itself into position. This would require a minimum amount of rocket fuel and could effectively push a string of satellites into orbit very quickly, almost like an artillery barrage. If the army needed to put special satellites into orbit in a hurry or, better still, explosive satellites that would pose a threat to orbiting extraterrestrial vehicles, the Big Gun was one method of accomplishing this mission. There was still a third potential to the supergun. General Trudeau foresaw the ability of this weapon to launch rounds that could ultimately be placed into a lunar orbit. Especially if hostilities broke out between the United States and USSR or, as we expected, between Earth military forces and the extraterrestrials, we could re-supply a military moon base without having to rely on rocket launch facilities, which would demand long turnaround times and be very vulnerable to attack. A camouflaged supergun, even a series of superguns, would allow us all the benefits of a field artillery or quick response anti-aircraft unit, but with a piece that could launch payloads into space. It was this combination of capabilities that delighted General Trudeau because it enabled one R&D project to help create many different systems. 113. The United States, Canada, and the British military combined their joint expertise to find ways to develop Dr. Bull's supergun with General Trudeau, I believe, becoming one of Bull's staunchest supporters. But by the time military budget decisions had to be made to fund the weapon, all of the government's military establishments had become committed to the guided missile and rocket-launched space vehicle rather than a supergun. While the weapon had some potential, the United States, UK, and Canada were too far along with their own missile programs to start up a completely new type of weapon. And in the end, they decided to end the research while still keeping close tabs on Bull's efforts to sell his technology to other powers, especially governments in the Middle East. Through the 1980s, Gerald Bull, whom I had met at a reception honoring General Trudeau in 1986, entered into negotiations with the Israelis as well as with the Iraqis and perhaps even the Iranians. The decade-long war between Saddam Hussein and Iran proved a fertile sales territory for weapons merchants in general, and particularly for Gerald Bull, who was courted by both sides. In the end, he cut his deal with the Iranians, testing experimental versions of a supergun and planning to build the monster weapon before the British intervened and seized shipments of gun barrel units before they were shipped out of the country. By this time, Dr. Bull may have become a liability to the Iraqis, as well as to the Israelis and to the United States as well, and was shot to death outside his apartment in Belgium before the outbreak of the Gulf War. Like Jules Verne's character Barbicane in From the Earth to the Moon, Bull had a vision of the potential of a long-range artillery piece. Unlike Barbicane, he came very close to proving it a practical way of launching vehicles into space. The murder of Gerald Bull has never been solved, and whatever secrets he still possessed about the assembly of a gun to launch vehicles into space probably died with him in the hallway outside his apartment. List of missions. As I worked through the stack of projects on my desk during the spring months of 1962, I found I was devoting more of my time to the Roswell file and less to some of the other projects under development. It was apparent to me that the treasure trove we'd retrieved from Roswell was beginning to pay off in ways that not even I thought would happen. There were so many Army research projects underway, I told my boss, that were not foundering, but sputtering along that could benefit from something similar found in the Roswell wreckage if we could find the match between the two. Night vision, lasers, and fiber optic communication were obvious, I said to him, but I was sure there were other areas we could find just by looking at the problems posed by what we discovered from Roswell, not just retrieved from the wreckage. Make it specific, Phil, the general asked. What do you mean? If you just look at what we didn't find at the crash site, I said. That goes a long way to explaining the differences between what we are and what they are. It also shows us what we need to develop if we're going to prepare for long periods of travel in space. Can you make me a list? The general asked. There are a lot of ongoing research contracts out there that could benefit from a list of things we'd have to concern ourselves with if we're going to be planning for space travel in the next 50 years. By the time our conversation was finished, General Trudeau had asked me to prepare not only a list of what were called the emissions at Roswell but a very brief report detailing the areas where I thought development needed to take place. So I assembled all the reports and information in the Roswell file and began looking for what was missing that I might expect to find at a space traveler's crash site. 114. There was no mention in any of the reports of any food source or nutrient, and no one discovered any food preparation units or stored food on board the spacecraft, nor were there any refrigeration units for food preservation. There was no water on the ship either for drinking, washing, or flushing of waste, nor were there any waste or garbage disposal facilities. The Roswell field reports said that the retrieval team found something they thought was a first aid kit because it contained material that a doctor said was for bandaging purposes, but there were no medical facilities nor any medications. And finally, the Army retrieval team said there were no rest facilities at all on board a ship, nothing that could be construed as a bunk or a bed. From this available data, the Army assumed that this UFO was a reconnaissance craft and could quickly return to a larger or mothership where all of the missing items might be found. The other explanation Dr. Herman Oberth came up with was that this was a time-dimensional travel ship that didn't traverse large distances in space. Rather, it jumped from one time-space to another or from one dimension to another and instantly returned to its point of origin. But this was just Dr. Roberts' speculation, and he would usually discount any of it the moment he believed I was taking it as fact. I believed, however, that the Ebbies didn't require food or facilities for waste disposal because they were fabricated beings, just like robots or androids, who had been created specifically for space travel and the performance of specific tasks on the planets they visited. Just like our lunar rover in the 1970s, which was a robot, so these creatures had been programmed with specific tasks to perform and carried them out. Perhaps their programming could be updated or altered from a remote source, but they weren't life forms that required ongoing sustenance. They were the perfect creatures for long voyages through space and for visiting other planets. Human beings, however, weren't robots and did require sustenance. Therefore, it would be necessary to provide for long-term sustenance and waste disposal needs if humans were going to travel long distances in space. Other scientists from our R&D ad hoc brain trust suggested that, indeed, this could have only been the scout ship that either got caught in our tracking radars from the 509th or from Alamogordo or was hit by lightning in the fierce electrical storm that night. They believed that the ship was navigated by an electromagnetic propulsion system. Other scientists suggested that even before we could generate the necessary power to drive such a propulsion system, we would have to have developed some form of a nuclear-powered ion drive first. As for the absence of food, Scientists suggested that this would pose a major drawback for long-term human space exploration.